Okie doke. We are now welcoming on to the show Brendan Devaney, presenter of the DL Debate. Hi, Brendan.
All right, Greg.
Good to have you with us. Shall we start with one of your guests, Declan McDermott? He's going to be on the show. Donegal Ladies Minors winning the Ulster Championship. Fantastic result. We need to see that conveyor belt of talent, don't we? And it's good to see them picking up silverware.
Yeah, and the timing couldn't be better, Greg, at the minute. I suppose in Donegal GAA, we're always looking for positive stories. It's been a tough enough year, and particularly with Maxie Curran, there's been a load of girls have decided to hang up the boots, and there's a new wave of girls coming through, and you can't have a better wave coming through if they're also champions. Beaten down by a huge scoreline, 5-11, they won 5, and they met at the start of the season in April, and there was only 4 points in it. So fair play to Declan and Barney Curran and others that are coaching the girls there. They're obviously getting the very best out of them. A huge, huge occasion for them to be champs at the weekend.
Yeah, indeed. Not so lucky for the Donegal male minors. Luke Barrett's going to chat to you. They come up short against Derry in the Ulster minor semi-final. But I suppose, too, as you're developing, you have to sort of taste defeat, too. None of us like to. But maybe that's part of it too. Maybe I'm being overly positive here. But anyway, go on, bring me down to earth.
You don't taste defeat too much. You're always top of the ratings, Greg.
I love you.
You're always opening the champagne. Here, no, do you know what it is, Greg? I was up in Oma Saturday, Killyclocher. What a fantastic setup. I'd never been to Killyclocher Club. Brilliant pitch, great setup. And as ever, Greg, you know, when you go around grounds there, the warmth of people, particularly when it's a club game, it takes it over, you know. There's such a good vibe there. People just can't do enough for you, no matter what it is. So this Derry team, I spoke to a couple of Derry journalists around it, and they were saying, even though Derry have won this competition a few years back, and that they were saying this is the best team they've ever seen at Derry underage. Boys is covering the sport for 20 years. So that was a task in hand for Luke's side. Now, first half, very, very tactical. I mean, even more tactical than you'd see in the senior men's game. Donegal sitting in because Derry have the ability to blow teams away, and they had done that at half-time for a lot of teams, including the last time we played them in the group stages. So it was 4-2 at half-time. Completely different Donegal second half. We really took the game to Derry. We couldn't get a goal. We had three kind of goal chances and a couple that maybe could have fell our way. Then if we had hit the back of the net, we might have had a chance to win the match, Greg. They pulled away towards the end and kicked a few scores. But listen, the lads give their all. That's all you can ask for. And certainly the work that the likes of Luke and Brendan Kilcoyne and young McLaughlin there is doing, coaching the lads, they're coming through in terms of they've, I suppose, developed very much this season, Greg. And again, that's all you can ask for.
Yeah, Derry, I mean, the future's looking really bright for them. They're going to be a bit of a powerhouse because, as I say, you know, the seniors are doing well. I don't think anyone really, you know, would relish going up against them. And then you've got the next tranche coming through as well. They're starting to get things right from the grassroots up, it seems, building from the bottom up.
Very strong schools, Greg, you know. Whereas we would, you know, look to Alexa St. Junans to go on the Ulster and fight out. Like, they have three or four schools playing at a certain level. So they're constantly churning out. Most of the counties in the north have one or two fairly strong schools. Like you say, Derry have four. And that is a big plus to them as well. Plus, just the pure love of the game in there. And most towns, you know, the football team is very important to the people there and that. So that's, as you say, Greg, it's hard to believe how bad it went there, but it's certainly turned now, and yeah, Derry and up and up, and we have to play them next in senior, which ain't going to be easy.
Yeah, indeed. We'll talk about that in a sec. Donegal Hurlers in action as well. Bit of a dead rubber, really. I don't know if there's nothing we can read into that, really.
Do you know what? We were in a huge lead in the game, Greg. So we decided to start with our better team and then take them off. And Wicklow did the opposite. So they finished strong and pipped us at the game. So what's to be read into? It's hard to know. But Mickey Record coming up now in a few weeks' time. Massive occasion for Donegal, Croke Park, Greg. I'd love to be down there to see them and support them.
Yeah. Are you going to be able to make it your way, are you?
I can, as long as Oisin. I'll jump on with Oisin, sure.
Well, he's in good form this morning. Text him when we're off air. He seems to, whatever happened at the weekend, is in good form. And you know, that doesn't come along too often, so.
Well, maybe the Saturday. It was a Saturday game. If he drove home from Clare yesterday evening, he might have been
that. Anyway, come here. Me and you are going to get into trouble. Stop it. Right, let's get the men's seniors against Clare. Obviously, we were able to listen to it. There was no live visual coverage of it as such. It sounded pretty dour in the first half, and we have to remember who we were playing as well in Clare, no disrespect, but whatever happened at half time, they regrouped and come out and put the tie to bed. A win's a win.
Listen, second half, unreal, Greg. Where did that come from? I mean, you'd have to be made impressed with the boys. As you said, 6-3 at half time. I was on Oma, just about to get reaction when I heard the half time score. I'll be honest, Greg, I wasn't surprised. I kind of thought to myself, you know, having watched this, particularly against Roscommon and against Down, I thought at real fears even going into this game, never mind the two that's to come. So to outscore Clare 11-3 in the second half was phenomenal. And, you know, looking into it there, really looks like some experienced players really stood up. And there was always going to be this, we know all about the injuries and the players have stepped down, but there's still a vast amount of experienced players in there. And it was up to them to kind of guide the team. And if you look through the ratings there, you know, Patton, Kieran Thompson, you know, Hugh McFadden, Chase McGee coming on at half-time, has input into that, you know, Keelan McGonigal. Like, a lot of guys there really stepped up. And, of course, their danger man, Keenan Sexton, McCall was brilliant, you know. And I just was watching McCall. He was really coming up and up. And I didn't think I'd seen the best of him this year, but Sexton's their danger man. And that was massive for him to get the better of him, take him out of the game. And, of course, he had a one-on-one Patton in the first half. Patton went in with a six-point lead. It could have been something different, but that's what happens in championship. So you'd have to say, well done to the boys, well done to the management as well, because that layoff, Greg, it was all, you know, everything was negative.
They've been through a nightmare, and I think, listen, this one win doesn't fix everything. There's stuff on and off the pitch, right? But these guys are out plugging away here, trying to do their best. Do you think if we're out there and there's a bit of negativity and we've given up on this season a little bit as fans, and I'm talking maybe particularly casual fans, not the hardcore element, that we get behind these lads for what's left of this now, particularly heading in against Derry, we try and sort of park the understandable maybe cloud that seems to feel, you know what I'm on about? It's like it feels like there's this cloud here that we need to sort of try and get ourselves out from underneath it and enjoy what's happening on the pitch as best as possible.
I think this performance, Greg, has pushed that away a bit, because I think everybody now that knows anything realizes we're in a bit of a tight spot. So that second half performance, brilliant, fair play to them. And at the end of the day, as you said, Greg, they're wearing a Donegal jersey. We had five players that kind of had their championship debut against Down and that. So we've young players in there, and it's hard on them now, because usually there's a buzz about Donegal and it's great to play and all that. So all this is kind of, and this is the first time in, so this is hanging over them a bit. So I think very much, we've got to park all the nonsense that was going now and support them now in these next couple of games. And as you said, these young lads have a future with Donegal. And I suppose until we start to turn the corner again, we just talked about Derry. Different counties go up and down a bit, Greg, but if we're really Donegal people, support people, we've got to still have that bit of, I suppose, pride and back the lads in terms of what they're trying to do, because, you know, everybody in there is trying to do their best, Greg, and it's just, there's so many sequence of events that's led to taking us a wee bit of a downward turn, but, you know, these things will turn again, no doubt.
Yeah. What did anything else jump out at you from the weekend? Mayo look strong.
You know what? You're trying to figure out games from different games. Yeah. So if you looked how we played against Down were Division 3, Clare were Division 2. But Clare were relegated and Down were very unlucky not to go up. Really, Down's on an upward trajectory, Clare on a downward. And I was thinking, what are they kind of similar? It looks like, you know, the Clare, we took them apart in the second half and they were at home. So you're looking at Mayo, Roscommon do a job on them. And then you're thinking, right, you know, Kerry will do the same. But Kerry going through Munster, playing handy matches. Next thing, this Mayo team, who are a good side, must have went away and really put the shoulder to the wheel. They've come back fresh and just took Kerry apart. That said, they probably should have won by a lot more, Greg. And not scoring goals has been a big issue for them, and they had a load of chances.
Yeah, but they go for goals. I mean, there's a strong argument to say that, and they got away with it this time. But there was a lot of points. There was a lot of points available there, and they opted to go for goal. And part of me likes that too. Don't get me wrong. But if they'd lost by one or two, it would all be about, you know, take your points and the goals will come.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned support there and the lads and that. Look at the Mayo support, Greg. It's always fanatical. And I know they've been up about the top this long time, All-Ireland finals and that, but it doesn't seem to matter. Even if they get beat the next season, first league game, you can guarantee packed house, you know, they support them. So I think all that there pushes young people to want to play for Donegal and representing that. So I think we've got to be wary of that. Even times are hard, can we can we get out and get behind the boys?
Yeah, right. Okay, you'll be running through all the action, as we mentioned, the guests already, but also former Donegal star John Gilday. He's in studio to give his opinions on the weekend's action with an in-depth look, as we mentioned there, as Donegal's win in the new All-Ireland series away to Clare, and of course, then what is to come. The show's live just after 7 p.m. this evening after the news. You can podcast it thereafter too on highlandradio.com, and you can listen to the DL debate in association with Sarah's Kitchen at Sister Sarah's Letterkenny. And of course, you're focusing on all of that, and then not too far down the line too, if you don't mind me mentioning it, you're a few weeks now away from your trip to Togo.
Yes, yes. Myself and Brad is going to document it, Greg. So we I do a bit of work for planning my spare time, sponsoring kids. So I sponsor ones myself, and then from that charity night we were at last year, we sponsored 23. So I'm going out to meet some of the kids and just document the trip and that. So there is a wee bit of Al-Qaeda in the north of the country. I've been joking with Brad, if you make a kidnap, will be the Togo too. So you never know what will happen out there. But there's a lot of safety protocols. I can't believe the amount of stuff you have to go through to go out there. It's between visas and permission from here and government and forms and that, you know. So, yeah, you fly into Paris and then it's 10 hours out to Togo. So there's a lady from Plan International coming with us as well. So we're going to see the work that they do out there on the ground. And as I say, meet some of the kids that we sponsor. Obviously, when you sponsor a kid, you get a pack and you get pictures of them and you can write to them and they write back to you and that, Greg. So you obviously have that. Sometimes that bit of a disconnect from someone in another part of the world, another continent. So we're going to try and kind of bridge that gap a wee bit and just bring home that kind of human nature of who you're helping out over there.
Yeah, and being able to document it too, it makes it more, as you go and sort of try and encourage others to do it, they get to see actually what's going on the ground and the connection between that donation and who they're helping, which is going to be really, really useful. Listen, we have a few more shows to go before that, so we'll chat to you next Monday. Thanks for the update on that, Brendan. And keep her handy, all right? Take care of yourself. Brendan Devaney there. Okay, back with more shortly. A caller says, I took time off work. I went to the tax office to tax my van. First time not allowed online, wasting guards' time stamping it. Tax office only doing motor tax 2 days a week. People need to use the service or lose it too. Online, that's in Cairns on it. Indeed, and that comes up from time to time when people realise the service is at reduced hours. Right, Ireland is becoming the first country in the world to have health labelling on alcohol products. The Minister for Health has signed the new measures into law, which will take effect in 3 years' time. Dr. Sheila Gilheeny is CEO of Alcohol Action Ireland. And I presume, Doctor, you're welcoming this move.
We certainly are. You know, this is something that public health advocates have been looking for actually nearly a decade at this stage. And indeed, the legislation was originally passed nearly 5 years ago. And it's only now actually being implemented, and as you say, another 3 years before it, you know, actually will appear on a bottle. So as you can see, with all of these measures, things seem to take a very long time, but it's definitely a positive thing. You know, it's really giving consumers, I suppose, you know, factual information that simply hasn't really been available to them to date. So the labels themselves are fairly modest. They're text-based. They give information about pregnancy, warning that not to drink in pregnancy, links between alcohol and fatal cancer, and link between alcohol and liver disease, as well as some basic information about the calories and the amount of grams of alcohol in the product.
But we don't really want to talk about it, it seems, as a nation, about the negative impacts of drinking alcohol. You'll see at the same time as the government signing this into law, they're also looking to extend opening hours, liberalising licensing laws. We have off licences on every corner now, and we're going to have even more coming down the line, more opportunity for people to drinking into the very early hours of the morning, despite people involved in alcohol harm saying this is the wrong way to go. So is this discreet labelling really feel just like a token? When you look at everything else we're doing, we're saying, you know, get it into you. That's how it comes across.
Yeah, well, I would certainly say that there's a policy mismatch between what the Department of Health are seeking, because they're actually looking to reduce alcohol use by about 20% in the country, and they've trying to do that through a series of measures, including minimum unit pricing, these labels, but and some controls on the advertising of alcohol products. And all of this will come out of legislation passed in 2018. But then, exactly as you say, we have another department, the Department of Justice, who are bringing forward legislation to increase the availability of alcohol. And one of the things that we would say is that, you know, alcohol is such a serious issue in Ireland. Like, literally 4 people die today. Another 4 will die tomorrow. Over 1,500 will die in the year. It costs us about $3.7 billion. It takes up about 11% of the healthcare budget. I mean, any of these statistics would be enough. You would feel for a government to say, gosh, this is a serious problem and we really need to tackle it. And one of the things that we would be suggesting is that there is a need for a central office, something maybe a bit like the RSA, Safety Authority, but an office that would take a holistic approach to alcohol harm reduction. And I suppose really, firstly, try to look at the policy measures which are needed, do the data analysis that's needed around it, you know, to really research and see what's going on, and then to coordinate right across all departments, because there's quite a number of different departments have an interest, if you like, within alcohol. So you have the Department of Finance, who would set duties or excise rates. But those rates haven't been increased in 10 years, so their value has been absolutely eroded by inflation. And then you have, as I say, the Department of Justice, and there's other departments. And then you come back to something like the Department of Health, or indeed Department of Children, who could be picking up really quite considerable tabs in trying to address the problem, when in fact what would probably be better is if we could, if you like, turn off the tap a little bit, or at least reduce the pressure at source on it.
Yeah, but even looking through the stats, and I get it, 2 out of 3 people will receive a diagnosis of an alcohol-related cancer. 16 babies will be born with lifelong conditions of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. 120 people will be hospitalised today being treated for alcohol-related liver disease. 4 people will die from alcohol. That's tragic. But it doesn't talk of the addiction, the disruption to families, the domestic violence, yeah, the fatal road traffic collisions. You know, those statistics almost feel as serious as they are the tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Like, 200,000 children today are living in homes that are seriously impacted by alcohol harm. You know, and as I say, there's any number of different statistics that we could use to try and highlight the harm that's there. So, as I say, I do feel that one of the things that is difficult for us is sometimes we instinctively know, yes, there is a bit of harm from alcohol, but at the same time, we don't want to know it. And one of the reasons that we don't want to know it is that we're surrounded by a massive amount of alcohol marketing. We're exposed to something like about 115 million's worth every year of alcohol marketing. And that doesn't even count things like sponsorship of sporting activities and things like that. That's just, you know, billboards and TV ads and things like that. Actually, they almost the basics of it. But we get such a powerful measure, a powerful, I suppose, it infiltrates our environment to such an extent that it can be difficult for people just to sort of step back from it and say, actually, do you know something? This is a serious problem that really does need to be addressed. So if we look and see what was done around tobacco, for example, one of the first things that really made a difference was banning the advertising of tobacco and cigarettes and smoking. And that is one of the things that helped people, I suppose, in that broader thing to say, actually, this is a harmful product and it needs to be regulated in a way that simply hasn't been done to date. As you would just say, there's almost like a free-for-all because we have alcohol available literally in every town, every corner, you know, of where we live.
They even want to allow it to be delivered.
Yes.
I mean, they even want it. So in other words, when someone is so paralytic at 3 a.m. that they can't leave the house, they want it a situation whereby you can deliver alcohol. So, like, I'm speaking to you and others, we've got fantastic representatives locally as well that we speak to who are calling for things to tighten up, yet we're going in the other direction. A report out this morning, 4,500 students were polled asking, you know, how their parents or guardians might view them if they got drunk. You know, attitudes are softening. 70-odd percent of parents would have been angry a few years ago. Now it's around about 53-50%. So in other words, attitudes are moderating in this regard. So it, rather than people seeing it as more dangerous and something to avoid excessively, and certainly whilst you're young and developing, our attitudes are going in the other direction, backed by seemingly government policy to further liberalise the consumption of alcohol. But just one other question, if you don't mind, Sheila. We're talking about, you know, bottles, cans that you might buy in an off licence or perhaps even behind the bar. But how does this get a message across to, I would argue, the majority of alcohol that's sold in a glass, for an example?
So there's two parts to this legislation. So one is individual warning labels on the can, on the bottle. And the second is that notices, effectively the same notice, giving those same warnings, also has to be posted and on a notice in bars as well. So it, the same information would be available. It's a small step. It's definitely not the silver bullet. But, you know, this was achieved against a backdrop of massive industry pressure, ferocious opposition to it. And I think the very fact that you can see that opposition from the industry tells you the power that's there and what it took. And it really did take leadership for the Department of Health and for Minister Stephen Donnelly to stand up and actually.
But it's not a done deal yet. I presume there actually will be anti-competition European-wide challenges to this. So the fight, if I could put it like that, there has not been won yet, unless that has been overcome. But I would imagine the drinks industry on a European basis will try and use European law to try and at least defer or delay this.
Well, that is a very typical tactic of the industry. But, you know, just to say that at this point, the regulations have already been through the EU single market notification process. And indeed, the Commission, you know, found and was stated indeed by the Commissioner for Health that these measures were proportionate to the scale of the problem that was being experienced in Ireland. So I don't anticipate a problem from Europe on this. And yes, of course, there's an industry which will always try and push back. But I think actually we have got this over the line.
And very finally, if you don't mind me saying, these decisions, Dublin-based decisions, often don't really consider the nuances, like for us, example, living in a border area, minimum unit pricing alcohol just means more people are going across the border to buy booze cheaper. And for those that buy that booze across the border, these warnings will not exist on the cans and bottles that they consume. But again, we're used up here to be being somewhat forgotten. These kind of actions really do need to be done on an all-Ireland basis if they're to have an equal effect for everyone.
Yeah, well, I completely agree. And indeed, there are moves, and we strongly support the moves in Northern Ireland to have minimum unit pricing. One of the things that I would hope from this legislation is that other jurisdictions are looking at this very carefully. We're very aware that Norway, for example, is also looking to move on cancer warning labelling on its on alcohol sold there. I would hope that Ireland, having shown leadership here, that this will extend to other jurisdictions. And clearly, we would want Northern Ireland and the whole of the UK to follow suit.
Dr. Sheila Kilheeny, CEO of Alcohol Action Ireland, thanks for your time this morning. Okay, I have in my hands here a book from Grand Alliance. It's called Wild Atlantic Woman, or Women, sorry, Walking Ireland's West Coast. And its author is with me now, Grand Alliance. Good morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's lovely to meet you.
It's a lovely book. I love the cover.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's that's kind of a lino cut, actually. It's an artist all she does is pictures of the Atlantic coast. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just subtle and I don't know. It stands out, but it's sort of not very terribly colourful, if that makes sense. I should have just left it at my first remarks. But it's just nice. It's just nice. So you walked Ireland's West Coast, Grania, and it was for you did it. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so kind of about 2019, I turned 40 and I was having a bit of a moment where all my other friends had kind of got married and had kids and done the thing, and I hadn't done that. And I was having a bit of a like, oh God, what am I doing? And I thought, okay, it's time to do something for me. And I'd always wanted to. My mum and dad are both Irish. I'm from London, but my mum's from Limerick and my dad's from Sligo. And I've always wanted to travel the Wild Atlantic Way. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do this, but I wanted to do it with intention, you know, especially because it's, you know, the country of my parents. I didn't want to just kind of, you know, sometimes people travel and they're kind of like, oh, I've done it. And I didn't want it to be like that. So I decided to walk, first of all, in the footsteps of my own great granny, who was from Cape Clear down in Cork, and then in different women up the coastline. So there's 11 different women and 11 different walks. And I kind of go all the way from Cape Clear right up to Marlinhead in Donegal. It took me, obviously, on and off. I wasn't walking the whole way, but it took me kind of 3 years to kind of do all of the 11 walks.
Yeah, because presumably, too, you wanted to be in the moment and enjoy it as well. You didn't want this to be necessarily primarily a physical challenge.
No, I didn't. I wanted to just really enjoy the landscape, and I wanted to have some time to myself to think. And I also wanted to learn some Irish history. Actually, by the time I got to Mayo, though, I was setting myself a few more challenges. So Gráinne Whale, who's obviously my namesake as well, so I'd obviously been hearing about her since I was a kid. The walk across Knockmore was the biggest challenge in the book. So I did sort of, you know, I suppose as I went on, I got into the swing of things. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, I they're not all really hard walks, but that one is.
Yeah. And you obviously, the concept was from the beginning, was it, that you were going to walk, that you were going to walk particular areas, having chosen particular women? Was that all part of it, or did that sort of come together as you were ongoing?
It was something I had the idea in my head very firmly that I would do this, and I knew that kind of I wanted to learn the story of my great granny. I knew that I wanted all the women I knew had to, if I was going to do it, I had to find women who were deeply connected to the landscape. You know, it wasn't going to work if it was sort of, I don't know, a war hero or something. It had to be people like Easky Britton in Donegal, who's a big wave surfer, or Queen Maeve, who's Kern in Sligo. It's actually part of the landscape. They had to be embedded in the landscape. But I kind of, I don't know if you've ever done something and then not known what you were doing until you've done it. It's good living.
That's my life. Yep.
Yeah. People say that about having kids actually, don't they? But I kind of as I was doing it, I got the hang of it. I realised it would be, I did a lot more walking that's in the book.
So what is the book then? And this is not a negative question, because it's everything really, okay? But the way in which you describe certain places, you paint a picture and experiences that are going to, that you could say, you know, I mean, it's going to attract visitors to these areas. They'll want to walk in your footprints. It also is focused on women. Is it a celebration of those women? And if so, in what context? And how much of this is about, you know, your personal journey? Because it was for very personal reasons that you decide to begin this project. So break down the book for us in what it is, or is it what the reader feels it is, or what did you want to create?
I suppose I wanted the reader to learn about the women that were in this sort of great landscape. But I knew in order to kind of make their stories captivating, I would have to intertwine them with my own walks in the landscape. So I knew when I started it, I knew it was going to be for me, really. And I had some idea that it would just primarily be about the women, and that as I kind of walked, I'd tell their stories. And that is the format of the book. But as I was writing it, I realised that in order for the reader to care, you know, in order for the reader to actually want to be with me on this journey, I was going to have to put more of myself into it. I was going to have to sort of put myself out there, as they say. I didn't really understand what that expression means, actually, until I had to do it. But so the journey is, The narrative drive is kind of going from the South Coast up to the North Coast, a lovely trip along the landscape, discovering these parts of the landscape. And you can do the walks, but to keep the reader reading, I think my own personal journey does sort of carry you along.
Yeah. Now, as a writer, documentary maker, and what have you, you're incredibly busy. Is this a one trick thing, or I mean, theoretically, you could write a similar book, you know, on your walks anywhere you chose in Ireland, anywhere for that matter.
Gosh, yeah, I haven't really thought about it. I mean, one of the reasons I did it was that I kind of wanted to do something completely independently of telly and just completely enjoy Ireland, you know, and also, you know, spend a bit more time with my parents in Sligo so I could combine this. So I haven't really thought about it beyond this. People are saying to me, oh, maybe, you know, maybe you should make a film, Grainne. So I'm sort of thinking about it, but I haven't really... You know, in a way, like the book, the beauty of the book for me was to have these moments of tranquility. Mm. So
this really is a more personal project, isn't it, really, rather than a platform for a massive series, a documentary and 25 podcasts. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I catch you. You want to sort of choose how you share it and how other people experience this with you. What was the experience? What was the experience like? You know what I mean? Because obviously you're meeting people, you might meet disgruntled landowners, I haven't a clue. But, you know, like, what was it like?
Well, I mean, I'm a city girl, so it was completely new to me to walk in the countryside. I completely didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, my perception of Ireland was always kind of going, especially that, you know, bits of Ireland that I didn't know was always kind of a family holiday. So I had no idea, but it was amazing, if I'm honest with you. Just... I had no idea when I set out how absolutely beautiful Ireland is, and also how incredibly, I mean, I don't want to use the cliche a lot, Irish people are really friendly, because I just feel like that's, but people genuinely were. I mean, my name is my passport in a way. I just got my Irish passport when I started the book, but my name, once people learnt my name and I told them what I was doing, they completely got it, you know? And they completely understood where I was coming from. So I did honestly have, I mean, there were ups and downs with any journey. And I did find the walking quite strange to be in such isolated places. But honestly, the beauty of the Atlantic coastline really propelled me.
It is stunning, isn't it? It's there if you just want to go and look at it too. Yeah. Okay. And... you have, well done. I think it's a wonderful achievement. And I think too that I try and avoid stereotypes, but hey, when they're positive, bring them on. Do you know what I mean? The book's out there now, Grainne. Where can people get their hands on it?
So I think it's
I should mention, by the way, Donegal features really quite strongly in this, as you've already suggested, Donegal in the Northwest. So tell us where it's available.
Oh, it's available sort of in all the bookshops along the North Coast. I just spoke to Des at New Ireland Books this morning. It's in Liba in Sligo, I know for sure. And I guess it's in kind of most of the bookshops in Donegal too. He's across that.
New Ireland Books as well and what have you. People will get their hands on it. It's Wild Atlantic Women, Walking Ireland's West Coast with Grainne Lyons. It's been lovely speaking to you, Grainne, and I'm delighted it was such a positive experience for you, and congratulations on the book documenting it all.
All right, thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. Well, nice to have you on the show. Grainne Lyons there. I'll just show for those of you watching the cover, just in case you're keeping an eye out for it, you want to have a look at it. There it is. Wild Atlantic Women. Happy 80th birthday to John McAteer from Lifford. John, this comes in for us all here across the Northwest, of course, but... also, particularly from your wife and your family. Have a lovely day. Also, a particular song being looked at here, I might pass it on to a later show, but I'll play the request part of it. It's for Sean McGlynn. Happy birthday, Sean, with love from Catherine. Your birthday is today. You're a Eurythmics fan, I understand, or at least this song has significance for you. Maybe one of the DJs later will play it. But anyway, for now, Sean McGlynn, happy birthday. Lots of love coming into you from Catherine. Right, okay. I'm going to take a break and get to our last guest of the show and your comments in a moment. Now, Pat McCart, former editor of the Derry Journal and columnist with the Daily Mirror, joins us. Pat, good morning to you.
Morning, how are you?
I am doing good, I'm doing good. Right, you know, some people were predicting before the local elections in Northern Ireland what would be a good result for Sinn Féin. They blasted through that and will be sitting very, very happy today, I presume.
Absolutely, Greg. They got 105 seats the last time. They got 144 this time. Now, some people thought they might get maybe no 5 or 10 extra seats, but they got, 39 extra seats. And they have, as well as that, they have gone way ahead of the DUP. The DUP basically are, as you were, they got 122 in 2019, and they've got the same again this time. So, Greg, I think the Sinn Féin are now the biggest party in the Assembly. They're the biggest party in local government. Now, if you work on the basis that the Northern Ireland state was formed for unionism on a basis of a majority of 2-1, the days are definitely changed and the days of unionist domination are certainly over. And I presume there are many people in the unionist community very concerned about that.
And where do the gains come from, and what does it mean in the broader political context? I can't imagine, or maybe I'm wrong, but you know, a unionist might go, well, I'm sick and tired of the DUP, I'm voting Sinn Féin now, or vice versa for that matter, because this stuff to's and fro's. So the Alliance made gains as well, and Sinn Féin made huge gains. So where are these votes coming from? Is it simply better vote management, more candidates, or what can we read from it politically, do you think, in terms of who they're attracting?
Well, Greg, the one big factor is the demographics are definitely running in favour of the nationalist community. I had an old mentor years ago, a man called Frank Kern. He was editor of the Journal before me, but he was big into all these demographics. And he claimed to me many, many years ago, everybody was counting the Catholic birth rate. But what they were ignoring was the unionist death rate. The unionist population was a lot older and they had less children. So the unionist population were getting it from both ends. They were coming up against the nationalist population that had a lot of young people. And then there were a lot of the older people were, deaths sort of knocked them off. So that's all coming into play. But already, Greg, 4 out of the 6 counties are already nationalist majorities. And this time Sinn Féin won in the unionist heartland. We have now got councillors elected for the first time in places like Coleraine, Ballymena, Lisburn. Years ago, they wouldn't have even had a look in. So it's all changing. It's massively different. And I was listening to Lord Kilclooney, former John Taylor, you know, former unionist minister, saying this changed nothing. Now, with respect, that's, you know, bordering on
whatever.
Well,
let me put the argument to it in that they would say they're unchanged. The DUP, for an example, at 122 seats, they would say, well, you know, this is an endorsement of our views on, the post-Brexit mess that exists. That, in other words, if they got it wrong, they'd have lost seats. So they're as you were. That's an endorsement of their policies, and they're not for changing. You don't buy that, though.
No, I think that's ridiculous, Greg. You know, that's like saying Manchester City hasn't won the Premier League because United won it last year. You know, that's when you're standing still and the other people are passing you out big time, you are not winning. And the unionism is not winning. And there's a sort of an attitude like burying their heads in the sand. Greg, something's going to happen or needs to happen. I think it was Naomi Long, the leader of the Alliance Party, described the Sinn Féin victory as a tsunami. And Greg, that is massive. No matter what way you come at it, they've gone up almost 8% on their vote the last time. There's sort of clear blue water coming now between Sinn Féin and the DUP, which is the biggest party in unionism. And of course, there's another factor. A lot of unionists are socially liberal and they're not coming out to vote for any of the unionists. They might come out in a border poll to keep the union, but right now they're not voting for any of the unionist party. So the unionism has got a problem that way. Like, a lot of people don't agree with the DUP's attitude towards, you know, maybe gays and various religious stances and like abortion and so on. So, like, Greg, there's all sorts of factors, but the reality is, if you're asking what is, by far, the Sinn Féin is now in the sort of driving seat. and Northern Ireland politics. That's really the key to come out of last Thursday's election.
And we seem to be in a momentum in a direction that we're never going back to. And I think you've recognised maybe the change in demographics in terms of, you know, the unionist population, for an example. But that's, I mean, obviously, like all parts of the world now, the population is growing in Northern Ireland, and it's not just unionists or nationalists. You know, there's all different types of people with different backgrounds. So Sinn Féin will be very happy in that they perhaps are, you know, the Alliance probably thought that they could reap the benefits of sort of, you know, soft nationalists or people who are indifferent to nationalism or unionism. But the Sinn Féin obviously got their message to those people as well. You just wonder where the likes of the DUP go from here, and even hardline unionism, where it goes from here to some extent, because there were no great gains in that regard either. It just, if you are a unionist, whether it's, you know, really hardcore or otherwise, you just wonder where it goes from here to make any gains. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does actually. Greg, I was watching a programme on BBC yesterday morning, the Northern Ireland Politics programme, and Mark Crowthers, the presenter, said, we tried to talk to Jim Allister of the TUV on several occasions during the elections, and he wouldn't come forward. And the TUV have been holding the DUP's feet to the fire in regard to this Windsor framework and the protocol. And it was expected hardline unionism would make a big inroads this time to the DUP vote. It hasn't. Now, the other side of the story is Alliance are roughly about 2%. I think it was 14 more seats this time. So they were expected to do probably better than that. But still, the trajectory is right. They're still moving up nicely. So they're happy enough. Greg, it looks like now it's Sinn Féin 1, DUP 2, Alliance 3, the SDLP and the UUP are starting to fall quite significantly behind. So there's three parties now. There's, what would you say, the left-leaning Republicans, the right-leaning the DUP, and in the middle of the Alliance?
Elsewhere, SDLP lost 20 seats down to 39, ain't too wiped out. Greens lost over, not far off half their seats. Independents down around 20%. So things are settling, I think, into a cycle here. So where does it go from here? What happens next? I think anyone looking at it, particularly from the outside, will look at those figures and go, well, can really the DUP at this point continue to sort of hold government politics to ransom in Northern Ireland? We heard from the Sinn Féin, they're calling for all of this to be looked at. I mean, the people of Northern Ireland, doesn't matter what their politics are, deserve a government. So how does one get formed from here? Because this can't continue forever, for crying out loud.
Well, Greg, look at it the other way. One out of every three votes cast in the election on Thursday last went to Sinn Féin. The DUP, one of the big reasons, Greg, let's get this on the record as well. One of the big reasons there's such a vote for Sinn Féin is the fact that the DUP have been basically holding the place to ransom until they get concessions on this framework document. Despite the fact that the Westminster Parliament passed it with a huge majority, they're still holding out. Now, Greg, if you cross over the border and look in Derry, there's places like Craigan on the Bogside, there are programs there for where there's, I mean, some of these places, there's 70% male unemployment. Social welfare programs are massive. And they're all going to be cut to the bone because the DUP are not going into Stormont. There's no finance ministers. Everything's getting cut. And a lot of people, there's going to be massive hardship. And of course, the other side of the story is the biggest waiting lists in either Britain or Northern Ireland, if you want to use those terms, are in Northern Ireland. Everything is just going wrong. And the DUP are saying, let them eat grass until we get what we want. And that has really angered, you know,
it feels though like the, you know, London will look on, Dublin will look on. The mandate to sort of hold the region to ransom is not, doesn't feel like it's there.
No, Greg, there's one of your competitors, the Nolan Show. It was a sort of it was a bit of an outlier, but I think it emphasised the change. There was a woman called Mary came on Nolan last week from Nottingham, and the abuse she gave the people of Northern Ireland that this flag waving and all this sort of holding out your hand and begging bowl, and you expect our people over here to pay for everything. I think the sort of the it's been overplayed, and there's a sort of a now a sort of an alienation almost in Britain towards Northern Ireland. And the DUP, I think, need to have a serious look at their strategy.
I still haven't got over Nolan's criticism of Donegal, but anyway, we'll get through it. All right, Pat, it's really interesting. We live in interesting times, and it's always a pleasure to get your insights into it all. Thank you so very much indeed.
All the best, Greg.
Take care. That's Pat McCart, former editor of the Derry Journal and columnist too with the Irish Daily Mirror. And your views too, please, to 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts to that number, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. Shall we have a look at a few comments as we head towards the end of the show? A caller says, it's cheaper now to go out and take illegal drugs than to drink alcohol. Where's the programmes and messaging about the dangers of illegal drugs? They're everywhere, cheap and available. And every time I read a text like that, I remember saying on this programme that drugs had become incredibly cheap and widely available. And I was corrected in relation to that, but I still maintain that that is the case. Ain't too averaged four of first preference votes. They stood candidates. The averaged... Just send that in to us again, please, because I'm not sure if that's a positive or negative. When I went to national school, we were taught that the summer months were May, June and July in Ireland. But nowadays, May seems to have been kept on in the spring, when sometimes mentioned in ads in the media. Looks like we're going backwards when it comes to basic knowledge and education. Well, you see, the summer from a meteorological perspective doesn't even start till the start of June. So depends on what way you want to look at it. Sharp Bin, back to this. I have a number there I was given just before Christmas. It's a Dublin-based number, Hibernian Healthcare for collection or replacement. They operate Monday to Friday. We have that number, Marie, by the way. We'll pass that on to Marie in any case. Staying with that, though, you can leave sharp boxes into the blood room in LUH. You absolutely can. Not put those sharp boxes into the general waste. They're classed as hazardous waste. Okay, and that's clear and good to get that cleared up. The quality of wine is not always defined by price, says a listener. I love the 3 litre cartons of wine you can get for a fiver. 3 litres of wine for a fiver. Is it paint stripper or what? Can you really get 3 litres of wine for €5? Ooh. Okay. A caller says, I've got a hangover just thinking of it. A caller says, I agree with that comment. Read, the hairdresser's working from home. Going to the hairdresser to relax in their home. It's children, dogs and nosy. Children's dogs and nosy neighbours. I'm sure that's not across the board, but I do take your point. I can just imagine you sitting there looking for colour, and just it's like being at home. Okay, listen, thanks so much to all of you who took time to listen to the show. It's really appreciated, and for those of you who watched it as well, and if you took your phone out and sent a message, greatly appreciated too. We're going to do it all again. We're going to roll it back and do it tomorrow morning again from 9, so please join us from then. Thanks to Caroline Orr, who researched and produced, assisted by Niamh working on the show. John Breslin's coming up around the Northwest in a couple of minutes.